I think a good data scientist doesn't necessarily have to use data to solve a problem. A good data scientist is someone who can come into an unknown domain, align with the subject matter experts of that domain, see it from their view, but then also see it from a view of data and understand how to apply certain algorithms back into that person's space.
I'm interested in maybe your journey towards freedom.
I think what separates me from many people is that there's nothing, no job beneath me. The way that I got here is that I saw a conference that was $3,000. I emailed the organizer. I said, if I have to scrub toilets, I will do it.
There's no roadmap for that. Like, what if you're coming out of Trinidad? What if you're coming out of India? What would be the most helpful thing for those people?
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Ken's Nearest Neighbors, the podcast where I bring in fascinating people from my world, talk about life, data science, sports analytics, content creation, and much, much more. I'm your host, Ken G. If you haven't already, we'd greatly appreciate it if you gave us a rating and followed the show. It helps us to continue to bring in incredible guests.
Mark, welcome to the Ken's Nearest Neighbors podcast. We had an awesome talk for like 2 hours last night.
Yes.
And I said, I just have to get this guy in. We have to continue this with some microphones and and a little bit of background because you're such an interesting guy. You obviously are a fellow podcaster, and I just could not wait to hear your perspective on quite a few more things and also learn your story.
Fantastic. I'm happy to be your nearest neighbor at this moment.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, how I start off this podcast every time is that I love to get an origin story. So where did you first get your experience with data? So was there a pivotal moment where you're like, wow, this is something I'm interested in doing? Or was this more of a progression over time?
It's funny enough you asked that question. I heard you ask that question to someone else and I was answering it in my head. And I have no love stories. It's a story of complete serendipity. So I did my bachelor's in chemical engineering. As I optimize for career, it's all about what can maximize for freedom, as we were talking about. And I didn't have any strong affinity. So I was like, chemical engineers get paid the most. So I'll do that. So I did that and I was like, I don't want to be stuck in a lab all day. I like being outside. I like freedom. So I got a scholarship to do my master's in systems engineering. And then there was a guy teaching this class on system engineering principles. And he said, Mark, this class is a waste of time. You should come do machine learning. I was like, dude, you're teaching the class. What are you talking about? He's like, yeah, come do something serious. And I was kind of like, okay, I'll go try it. I was kind of useless as a programmer at that time. And it was quite painful. And I learned how professors sneak you into a summer class, not because they like you, but because they need numbers. And that was the first sort of foray into start thinking about solving a problem given data. And that's kind of how I got started. So it wasn't a love story. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a love story now. It's more of a curiosity fulfillment, if I could say that.
I like what you're saying that it's not a love story now, because that's also how I largely see this domain. I view a lot of the work that I do as a means to an end. Right? There are problems that I'm inherently interested in understanding or solving, and machine learning, data analysis, using SQL, whatever it might be, is one of the most effective means to the ends that I'm interested in.
Yep.
And I think so many people see data science, machine learning, AI, whatever it is, and they think that that's the end. But to me, it's so much more about what we can create with those things in the longer term. And I think for the vast majority of people, they realize that's what it is.
Right.
Right. There's all this AI hype. There's all this stuff now. But, you know, AI is not, you're not excited about it because it's just like cool. You're excited about it because of the benefit that it can have to humanity. You're excited about it because of all these other factors that are the applications of it, not necessarily the inherent thing.
Yeah, just doing AI for AI's sake, for instance, like, oh, we're going to find AGI. I'm like, that's cool. What's the next thing we're going to ship to production? You know, what's the next product we're going to make? And, you know, I was thinking, well, what does it mean to be a good data scientist? And I think a good data scientist doesn't necessarily have to use data to solve a problem, which is interesting. And a good data scientist is someone who can come into an unknown domain, align with the subject matter experts of that domain, see it from their view, but then also see it from a view of data and understand how to apply certain algorithms back into that person's space. So
that's an awesome definition. I mean, at a high level, a data scientist is an effective problem solver.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I will never forget this in my consulting work. We partnered with a very large tech company. I'm not going to say who it was. And we had a very specific problem that I had what I believe is a fairly elegant solution. It's a simulation approach. It worked very well, very consistent. You know, it runs on CPU, a couple of minutes, done mm-hmm. every single time. Yeah. Didn't have to be produced, just producing a report. And they wanted to create a machine learning solution for the same thing. And it was essentially machine learning is the answer. What's the question? And that drove me absolutely insane because I didn't view it as a machine learning problem. It was a very straightforward simulation problem because there was essentially a closed loop. Mm-hmm. There was dependencies between these things. Machine learning, it's a lot harder to handle dependencies
right.
where there's, again, this like closed system. And so I'm like, dude, this is simulation. And they wasted a ton of time, a ton of money, a ton of effort. And I will also say that their data scientists did not know how to code. They were just always using internal tools, which also, but again, that company will remain nameless. I might have named it in past episodes, but to me, that's the epitome of what you're describing is, I think data science is so much broader than just the data and the scientific aspect. Or maybe it is exactly that, data and then science. Science is effectively at a macro level all about just problem solving, testing hypotheses and these types of things. And data is something that can complement it in a very unique way.
I think it's also a function of where you get to express that problem solving ability. So I think if you could think of three buckets, one, the hyperscaler data scientists. The hyperscaler data scientists see a scale of problem, have access to compute at a certain level that gives them a space of solutions that they can explore. Then there is the, I would say, low resource data science realm where you might have a small laptop, you're in a legacy domain. Like I worked in the railroad industry when I graduated with my PhD and I was just like, yeah, you're doing world-class data science on, it was actually
on a brick.
HP top actually. And I was running this project on, it was $1 million project and it all ran on my laptop. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then now I'm at NVIDIA, very different mindset and how you go about solving problems. So I think it's always good for anyone in their machine learning, data science, data analytics career to understand the end application is that's the thing that we're going after. Algorithms, data, hardware, all of that stuff is a mechanism to do certain things. And I think the purest ones find a solution that satisfies customers. And the last thing I'll say there is I think sometimes as folks explore the market, there has to be this distinction between, is this an end customer application or is this a research paper? Those are like two very different games that you optimize for. And I don't think a lot of people get to play in the research realm.
Yeah, the majority are on that side.
Yeah, we're all here. It's struggle land.
Well, I want to go a little bit more into your background. Obviously, you're an international. You're international going into education and things like that. But I also, before we get into that, want to touch on how you actually made that transition from essentially we're working on this local machine doing everything for millions and millions of dollars of you know, value or whatever it is that's created
right.
to scaling up to this more system scaling infrastructure approach. How do you psychologically make that transition?
I think you make the transition from aligning to the problem. So for instance, in the railroad, you understood the constraints. I'm deploying some algorithm out somewhere in the Midwest that has no internet connection. Clearly there's no compute. So that business constraint narrows my field of view of potential solutions. And then when you come to NVIDIA, you understand that, okay, you have this platform that as a unit can be very powerful and then pool as units could be more powerful. So then you come back. So I work a lot with retail clients. So you try to understand their workload and then you understand, okay, is this a single GPU workload, multi-GPU workload? And you also try to align the problem along sort of the computational pattern that's happening. Right. So for instance, transformer models run really well on GPUs. Actually, data processing runs really well on GPUs. So it's me being aware of all of the things that GPUs could do. So as I interviewed for NVIDIA, I hadn't had a ton of experience with GPUs. But what I did have was I can align to a domain, I can understand the problem, given these new sets of tools, I can go solve that problem. And I think if you can prove that, it gives you an entry into transitioning into sort of a more scalable hardware career.
Yeah, we had a conversation with Chris Diat last night.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
And for those that don't know, hopefully he'll be on the podcast eventually, but he's a four-time Kaggle Grandmaster, one of the most prolific Kaggle competitors of all time. And something that was really interesting to me is how much he talked about experimentation and the creative side of problem optimization. And that's dramatically different than people who are working on a local environment, in the sense that your goal is to create a acceptable and positive outcome for a company creating value, yes, but there's more, and there's certain time constraints. And so it's more about building the structure and testing it than it is about the pure experimentation side. And you get more experimentation when you have scale and you can run on multiple different computers, multiple different GPUs, all these types of things. Obviously, there's still experimentation, a tremendous amount of it in this early stage.
Yep.
But the scale of his experimentation as he moves up in hardware is dramatically different than the scale and the type of problem you're trying to solve as a data scientist working on a local machine for a specific problem for a specific company. Like, your goal is to find a good solution. It's probably not to optimize for the best solution.
Yes.
But there's a whole other branch of data science where you're trying to optimize for the best solution. Even if you're not doing a Kaggle competition, there's, you know, in the largest companies where you have all these massive volumes of data, you get incremental value from every quarter, eighth of a percent you classify better. And to me, that difference had to have been a paradigm shift as you go across domains, or you go from working with smaller data to larger data.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. I think when I first joined NVIDIA and I learned about the KGMON team. So basically, KGMON team is Jensen said, hey, I want the top 10 Kagglers and we'll bring them. And your charter is to leverage the compute platform to showcase the benefits of accelerated compute. And when you learn that they can explore the feature space so much faster than anyone else, that allows them to align to the best solution. And I think the same is why a lot of people look at the platform for training, large-scale training. It's really time compression. And in my opinion, NVIDIA is a time compression company, because if you train this big model and you go through and you get an error, but it took you 3 months and you're like, oh crap, that was a bad run, I need to go back and spend the next 3 months, your scaling out or scaling up of hardware, allows you to just experiment faster and faster. And even so, that KGMON team actually is very pivotal in showcasing for the regular data scientist workflow, GPUs can actually accelerate you. Just try a bunch of different feature sets as fast as you can, and then you can get the deployment. And
it's really interesting you said a time compression company. So I thought it was really interesting in the keynote that Jensen gave when he was talking about the upgrade to the Blackwell chips. Mm-hmm. He said the same, like a smaller number of Blackwell chips would train XYZ model in the same amount of time as this larger number of, what's the one that's
Hopper.
Hopper chips. And instead of saying that with the same number of chips, you would train this model XYZ amount faster, right? To me, that's a very interesting distinction that he made. Is that okay? Like, less resources, same amount of time. You could have also gone the other direction with more resources, less time. And so I think it's not just time compression, but it's also like resource compression, which is also like a very beautiful thing. And like, those time and resources are like functionally cost, right? Which is neat how these all tie together very uniquely.
I think what I've learned also working on NVIDIA, accelerated compute is sustainable compute. So if you have a workload that's not accelerated, you're potentially wasting energy, right? So that you have this hardware, or you procure these compute resources and they're not being maximized to their full utilization, you're not necessarily being technically as responsible. And in like working with people, you realize, here's a thought experiment. An unoptimized SQL query is wasted money. If you think about it, right? Yeah. So, you know, and especially in the cloud, like you make a query, you spend a certain amount of time, and based on how you run that query, that processing engine will process this data either efficiently or inefficiently. So I think what's really cool about LLMs, I attended a talk with Baidu yesterday. So there was, they have this LLM, they talk to it, it'll generate SQL under the hood. In that SQL, they have a scheduling layer that figures out, hey, can this query be optimized on CPU or GPU? If it can be optimized on GPU, it gets it done because it runs it faster. Because in that environment, you have very low latency constraints. Ain't nobody going to wait 5 minutes to get back a SQL query. I need it back now. So you're seeing this blend of this hybrid nature of hardware, both hardware pieces and this routing mechanism to get things done. And yeah, I think this year, next year, you'll see people start to say, hey, can I actually optimize this more and more? And I think that's what NVIDIA, I've personally learned being at NVIDIA is, how can you come to this sort of speed of light? And speed of light just meaning, what is its purest form of doing things?
This episode of Ken's Nearest Neighbors is brought to you by Z by HP, HP's high compute workstation grade line of products and solutions. Z is specifically made for high performance data science solutions, and I personally use the ZBook Studio and the Z8 workstation. I really love that the Z workstations can come standard with Linux or WSL2, and they can be configured with the Data Science Software Stack Manager. With the Software Stack Manager, you can get right to the work of doing data science on day one without the overhead of having to completely reconfigure your new machine. Now back to our show.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of the hype around AI, large language models, is brute force, where more compute. But my expectation is the next leap will be from either optimization or from a different framework, right? You look at Transformers. Transformers completely changed the landscape of AI and generative stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Now, OpenAI is essentially saying that the greatest advancements were coming from data and compute and just training more and more. But that wasn't like what shifted the paradigm to begin with. Right. The paradigm shift was a better structure. And I think naturally the next structure will create that same type of, you know, slingshot, like takeoff effect. And, you know, as it relates to what you're saying is that so often we're now, and companies are now just throwing compute at things. But in my opinion, you actually get the greatest returns with massive compute, but also with the change of thinking or the change of architecture or a new algorithm or whatever it might be.
Right.
But we got so wrapped up because it's easier right now to just pay for more compute than it ever has been. But again, you don't make the greatest advancements just by paying with compute, which is an interesting thing.
Yeah, I think one anecdote to that is, so you're familiar with the scaling laws, right? That says, so it says in order for you to reduce your generalization error, you know, and Jensen highlighted it in his keynote. So your compute, your data size, and your model all have to increase sort of simultaneously. And there's actually an interesting distinction. There's a paper from OpenAI versus a paper from DeepMind. So DeepMind was saying, okay, given a certain amount of compute, what's the optimal model and the number of tokens that I need? So it's a kind of a reverse problem because the other one is just like, okay, I have unbounded compute. But the reason that I think a lot of folks are going after the larger and larger compute is, what is the bound? What is the upper limit of scaling? And I don't think it's necessarily been reached yet. I think it's been reached with the current data sets. And if you look at many interviews across different people on these teams, is the training data mixtures becomes very important. It's still very open, you know, how much Reddit versus how much YouTube versus. And I think it'll be even more interesting now as you start adding multimodality, right? What visual content is going to affect understanding? And then, as Jensen was saying, physics. How, when these things start to understand physics, how is understanding within a model going to change? But all of that to say is that I think every team is spending, you know, tons of effort on curating data. And what was cool for me to learn is that when you see, hey, explain this legal document like it's five, there was literally a lawyer that wrote that. And they hired a lawyer to write a sample of that so that this model could learn how to sort of pattern match from super complex to simple. And I think there's actually going to be a very interesting opportunity in data labeling as a career for you to hone your expertise to align an AI to a specific domain.
You know, it's interesting talking about multimodality and talking about sort of limits of data that you have. I actually think from an image and video perspective, that is virtually a solved problem based on the technology that I've seen.
Okay.
Right. All so right. It's not that we necessarily have to generate those things, but we have physics engines, Unreal Engine simulation that can generate those things at rates that are unbelievably high. So we can be training a lot of these multimodal models, largely just the video and the image side, on data that is not necessarily like AI generated, but is physics engine generated.
I see.
And
it's simulated.
Yeah, simulated data. And to me, that is like, that's a lot harder to do with text even. You could probably do it with audio relatively well, but the text and the audio would be coming out of other AI models.
Yep.
The simulation engines would be coming out of, I mean, yes, there's probably some AI component, but they'd be coming out of essentially like randomness imparted into like real physics bound interpretations of the world. Yes. And to me, that's a very interesting thing. It's like, oh, we're running out of data. Well, like in this specific area, we actually aren't running out of data. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Like it's unlimited. And so to me, it's like, oh, well, we have to think about scaling and what we can do. Like, there's other problems, especially in the video generation side and those types of things that I've been working on than the data side.
Okay.
Right. I mean, yes, you have to like aggregate it. You have to be able to make this into a system that produces it reliably and whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But like that is less of a problem, I believe, than the other two components of that.
Yeah. And I think that's why Jensen's really excited about, you know, I'm quoting Jensen, but just in general, as a thought experiment, Omniverse is just super interesting. Imagine if you did everything in this virtual world, and you have infinite scenarios that you could generate, right? Without actually, and I think that in the end, that's more sustainable from a implementation perspective as well. And then it'd just be cool to go into new worlds, and I don't know, everybody could be an architect at some point.
Yeah. Well, I didn't realize we did the tour of the NVIDIA campus with a couple of content creators.
Oh, nice, nice.
I didn't realize how involved he was in building it. It's like wild that
he actually, had so much. I personally think, off the record, I'm on the record, but I actually think he's a robot.
It could be.
You know,
be.
Like he's just...
Jensen, prove to us you're not a robot.
Yeah, he's just beautifully precise. And I do this thing where I go every so often, I go review all of his old talks. Because I think for my own career, just seeing how involved he is across so many different domains, I think it's just beautiful for you to... how pure first principles thinking and how far that can get you. But I actually think that entire campus was simulated before.
It was. Yeah. They were telling me the first DGX machine was created because he wanted to simulate it, and they didn't have something on hand there that they could simulate. And then, so obviously that first DGX machine was then passed off to OpenAI.
He really pushes us. He pushes us to, not to achieve perfection, but to at least outline that. And use that as a guiding principle for the work that you do.
I mean, something he talked about, you talked about, is first principles. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something, one of my favorite podcasts is the Founders Podcast. And that's something you see across a lot of people, Elon Musk, you see it across Steve Jobs. It seems like that is a prerequisite for innovators, which I find really interesting. What are your first principles?
My first principles align to someone's domain. Because sometimes, so for instance, I'll give an example in the railroad. I come into the railroad with absolutely no experience. And then I sit down with, so in the railroad, just for everyone to know, I was working on signaling on tracks. So the way that the freight railroad runs in America is that there are these blocks of tracks, and then they send a signal on the track. So it's literally the rail is a communication network. There's nothing else remotely controlling a train. And they determine occupancy based on these signals that they send up and down the track. That's why they fine you thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars if you go on the track and you mess with it, because you're stopping like these billion-dollar operations. What you learn in that environment is that, oh, if I can align to the first principles of, hey, how does electricity go through a piece of metal? How does it degrade over time? Do you know the rocks on a railroad track are very specific. Mm-mm. They are curated. All of those pebbles along the railroad track, they are curated so that there's minimal electricity loss of that signal in between blocks. So it's not like you just see they just throw random gravel. If you go, it's very uniform gravel, and that's called your ballast. And So you understand, you try to come into a domain and you understand what are the principles of that domain that allow that domain to operate in reality. So for me, what I've absorbed from first principles is just, what is the current truth of how reality is running? And then the flip side to that is, if we broke those down to the basics, how much better could it be? And just speaking plainly, simply, as much as you can, I think allows many more people to participate in the discussion.
Yeah. I mean, I love that idea of, like, what are the physical limitations, right? What is the science, like the very most basic science behind any of the things that we do? And then how does that relate to the domain? Because the domain is built on the foundation of the science of the domain, and yeah, we can work up from there. I think so many people go from the top down, where they're thinking about the problem. Oh, I want to get a data science job. Like, how do I work all the way down from there?
Right.
Instead, maybe it makes more sense to think of, okay, well, do I want a job? Right. If I do, what makes me employable? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do I tie what makes me employable with what I like? I like technical things, like building things. I enjoy coding. Okay, well, maybe I would like programming. Maybe I like software engineering. Okay, well, I like problem solving a little bit more. I like open-ended problems. Maybe data is a really good domain, mm-hmm, right? And so it's built on a bottom-up hierarchy of what your understanding is, rather than this end state that isn't based on the foundations of your own personal interests, which, yeah, maybe is a bit of an abstraction from like the core of what your work is. But I see that so frequently with almost everyone in the professional setting, right? I mean, I think there's some maybe 20-30%, completely random number, but that really know why they're working, and it's based on their own base principles, which I think we all can have. But
I have a contrarian view to that.
Yeah, hit me.
There's big narrative. So a book that really helped me in my PhD was Be So Good They Can't Ignore You,
yep,
by Cal Newport, right? And the thing that I took away was, the follow your passion thing is not probably the best thing for different reasons, but more so the better you got at what you were doing, the more you enjoyed it. Fantastic. The flip side to it, the follow your dream paradigm is, I often say to people, that's an American luxury. Right, versus for myself, like if I followed my passion, I would have never gone to school. I would have probably started working from like 17, 16. I'll be surfing all around the world. But now I'm fortunate to work for the top machine learning company in the world. I was fortunate to get an education, but I had to do all of those things. There's so many things I had to suppress along the way. So the flip side to that, in terms of, I want to become a data scientist, especially as an international student, you don't have that luxury. You're like, I have to become whatever the market demands. And that sometimes forces you into these very long, uncomfortable stretches of who you feel as a person versus what you have to do to get an opportunity, right? So now that I have a green card, I can now be like, oh, I'm going to have 3 podcasts. And I'm going to explore sort of who I was that you had to sort of contain to achieve a certain point. So I just highlight that in terms of, for those that are maybe on visas or international students, that your path to this, I want to become a data scientist, is actually not, it would be very different to an American. Every time I meet an American, I remind them, or anyone who is of a, you know, I come from Trinidad and Tobago, it's a tiny island. And I think it's slightly very different for the Indian community. So I have a lot of Indian friends. It's nice for them to go back home. You have an entire huge continent of many different industries. I go back home as a smaller island. It have oil, but the oil is, you know, how those things. So when your opportunity is limited, I'm not necessarily a big fan of, so 2 things. One, I'm not a big fan of this quote unquote brain drain where people leave. I actually believe that brain drain from a country is an ambassador program. And I'm sort of proving that hypothesis by interviewing people who've come from the Caribbean and just showcasing, hey, I am a Caribbean person. Do you know how many Caribbean people there are at NVIDIA? Take a guess. Out of 30,000 employees, guess.
Less than 0.5%?
It's 20.
20. Very, 20, very 20 less than 0.5%.
You know what I mean? So, I didn't appreciate or realize this psychological, it's not damage, but it's more of a psychological thought of, wow, you really come from a really small place. You're in a very small select group of people. And I think a lot of us, when we want inspiration, we see someone like us and you're like, oh, hey, I could do that. So all of that to say, align with the constraints that you have in front of you as you chart your career. But as you're saying, do your best to align to what I think you do best along with the marketplace. So I just wanted to...
No, I agree. I like that so much. I think that that's important nuance to what I'm saying 100% is that I view that as one of the base principles. Like, what scenario are you coming from, right? Like, what are the opportunities available to you? I think let's take your India example or something along those lines. Like, the base principle of being a data scientist is not the only path, right? There's plenty of other paths. Let's say you are chasing opportunity. Does opportunity necessarily have to be in the United States?
Yep.
Right? I think that there's this overarching thought process that there is one or two paths that are great because they're publicized, you're making a lot of money.
Yep.
But inherently, if you look at the base principles beneath those, you realize that, oh, I could actually go multiple different routes that align more with my own strengths and the things that I'm interested in within the confines of what I'm doing. And I'd actually face less competition. I would have better personal opportunities because I'd have more motivation, more of these different things aligning at that thing that is relevant. So I 100% agree with you. I think that what I definitely want to articulate, though, is that no one in the world, maybe in like North Korea or something like that, but no one is confined to just the specific domain. And that to me is something that it like makes me very sad because I see a lot of people that are like, oh, you know, data scientists make so much money. Data scientists do X, Y, Z. And then you're like, and then they're like, I hate to code. Or they're like, I need people to tell me exactly what to do. And,
right.
And those are, you know, there's plenty of jobs where if you just do exactly what you're told, you can be really effective.
Yeah.
That is data science. In almost every aspect of it is not one of those. And so to me, like that is something they should know about themselves and they should know about the domain and then they can reevaluate. I mean, it's a matching problem.
Yes.
And we're like improperly matched because we haven't done the homework about what the true domain is and who we are and our attributes. So I actually love that Cal Newport book. I've read every single one of his books. But I think that there is like, there has to be some element of what we are drawn to. Like if we fight the grain too much, we're going to be in a little bit.
There's a thread that you told me before we started about freedom.
Yeah.
And for me, that's been my optimizing factor. What gives me the most amount of freedom? And for me, the skill of a data scientist allows me to go to any domain.
Yeah.
So 100%. So even if I'm like, oh, I wake up and do data science, like Christy, you're spending 15 hours a day coding something 7 days a week. I'm like, wow, I admire him.
I admire him, but I do not want to do that.
Yeah, I was like, that's a different story. but for me, it's interesting being at NVIDIA. If I didn't do machine learning, I would not have the opportunities that I have. And the marketplace is in such a form where, oh, my skill is in very high demand. So I think, yeah, I just wanted to point that out too in terms of like freedom is like, this is a technically one path to freedom. And as you're saying, we're all trying to find these paths to what we're optimizing for.
I agree 100%. Well, I'm interested in maybe your journey towards freedom.
Yeah.
Right. So I'd love to hear and understand how you went from, like Trinidad and Tobago
yep.
to working in NVIDIA or like going through your PhD program and all these things also, like, to me, that's like a pretty fascinating journey. And could you sort of walk me through that?
Yeah. I'll start from the beginning, but I'll try to highlight some takeaways for people as we go along. Come from a small island, Trinidad and Tobago. Try to keep my accent as much as possible. So number one, your accent where you come from is a beacon actually out in the world. So I came in, I was 18, 2006, came to do chemical engineering. I went to Florida Institute of Technology. I applied on the last day of like a bunch of different schools and that was the only one that took me. So in high school, I'm a complete slacker. So anyone that hears that I have a PhD, they're just like, that guy got a PhD. It's like, I was the last one that you would think. I didn't even think that I could necessarily do it.
Actually, me too. I'm a terrible student in high school, halfway through college, and then figured something out. But
And so I get here, I'm like, okay, chemical engineering. So the thought process is Trinidad has oil, and I'm always a kind of worst case doomsday kind of scenario kind of person. Okay, so worst case scenario, if I have to come back home, these guys make the most amount of money. So when I figure out what it is I want to do with my life, I'll at least have a lot of money to go do what I want. So that was the guiding light. Going through it, I'm just like, I don't care about this. My first year, I went home and I told my dad I want to be a chef because I love cooking. He just looked at me and he said, you will finish your degree. And my father is a person you don't say no to. He was very big and strong then. So I finished my degree. I was like, wow, I really don't want to do this. And when you're an international student, I think the internationals know, but it's good to just rehash this for everyone. When you enter a degree as an international student in the US, if you fail a class, quote unquote, technically, you get deported. So this is why you see international students, you know, it's a significant investment. Their family pulls a bunch of money, gives them a shot, and it's their responsibility to pull the family forward into opportunity. So when you graduate, if you do a STEM degree, first when you graduate, you have 12 months of work authorization in the US. You have 3 months to find a job when you first graduate. So if you don't find a job in the first 3 months, you technically have to leave by the law. If you do get a job and you have a STEM degree, at the 9 month mark, you can apply for a STEM extension that gives you 2 years, but you need to have a full-time job at that point to push into that 2 years. And in those 2 years, your hope in those three total years, your hope is someone sponsors you a work visa, a H-1B visa. But that is also a lottery now. So for folks previously, I don't know, 10 years ago, it was not a lottery. So you apply, get it done. Now it's a lottery. So after each terminal degree, if you're in STEM, you get three of these. If I do two bachelors, I don't get an extra one. So you finish your bachelors and then you sit to try to get a job. I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship. I wasn't getting any jobs anywhere in chemical engineering. So I did that and I was like, okay, I'm not doing chemical engineering. Screw that. I'm going to do systems engineering. It had sort of least prerequisites. Looking back, I truly wish I did computer science. To me, computer science is one of the purest degrees and it gives you the most leverage out of many different degrees. So anyway, do that. I meet my advisor. He's like, yeah, you're wasting your time. Come do some machine learning. So I was practically useless as a coder, but there's one thing I wouldn't give up. If someone put the time into me, I would really do whatever it took to be successful. So after that summer class, I was actually able to he gave me a 1 year internship and he's like, okay, you need to go learn classification of internet data. So I learned about anomaly detection and all that type of stuff. And mind you, I hate school. So school is just a forcing function to opportunity. Okay. Finishing my master's, so you're coming up on this next OPT, right? So I get this interview with Microsoft. So I go out to Microsoft, I get flown out. And when you get flown out to the big companies, you feel good, right? So everybody interviewed. I actually had a friend. He didn't interview me, but he was interviewing others. And afterwards, he's like, congrats, you'll do well, you know. Basically, like, I got soft confirmation and I might get in or something. I knew everybody else who would have gotten offers. And I'd stay in contact with all of them because we all kind of went as a cohort. They all got offers. I was the only one who didn't get an offer. And I don't think I've ever felt crushed beyond that. So when you hope to get a job to just break out of school, to just explore who you are, and now you have to keep in mind, if you don't finish this degree, you get deported. And for me, being deported means like I should go back to a small island versus India, I have a whole market. And the other thing too is my advisor was like, okay, you have an option. When you graduate, so now I'm in my master's, I get the second block of 3 years to hopefully find a shot at a visa. It's like, you should just hurry up and do your PhD. And I was like, dude, a PhD? What are you talking about? Because in a PhD, you're not guaranteed to graduate, right? So eventually I was just like, all right, I need to jump. Because I really liked him. He put in a lot of work into me. And one thing he really stressed on us is that your presentation skills needed to be so well. And his depth of editing was so painful. And he gave us a sort of very traditional PhD, very difficult. You basically suck until like you're You're like, okay, you say it, you suck. And then you just tell me like, you suck. And, but it was in a really meaningful way to be like, you can do better and sort of guiding you along. So anyway, I decided to jump to do my PhD. So I'm like, okay, I have to do this thing. And so just for folks, the process of a PhD, you do your first year of class. First, you find an advisor. That's 99% the most important thing. So I start doing that. You finish your classes. You do a qualifying exam. So all this time, you're equal to a master's student in a very traditional hardcore PhD. When you're 70% done with your research, then you do your proposal. And that's when you finally become a PhD candidate. Your advisors start giving you some semblance of respect. And then you do your defense, right? So that's the sort of overall process. And in that time, what I started seeing deep learning. And I told my advisor, hey, I want to switch to do this thing. So I did 2D and 3D shape matching. Completely arbitrary subject. So a strategy, personally, there are two types of people that do PhDs. One, the only person that finishes a PhD is the most persistent person, not the smartest person. Because I know a lot of smart people they're not persistent enough to finish through the edits. So going through my PhD, I was like, hey, this deep learning thing is coming. So I start go volunteering at conferences. So this part of the story is very important because volunteering has been the key to my success, not necessarily applying for jobs online. So I volunteered for a bunch of different conferences. So I volunteered for this conference called the Southern Data Science Conference. So I met a gentleman there and he ended up giving me a letter for my green card, et cetera, et cetera. So I graduate, I finish my PhD. I was like, okay, I got an internship. This is another important story. I think a lot of students who don't get internships during their tenure, there's a lot of anxiety that comes, especially as an international student. You're not good enough. I got my first internship in my last year of my PhD. So think of 2006 to 2017, just full block, straight through, no breaks. Just that was my path. So you get it. And then in my internship, they're like, yeah, we're going to give you a full-time offer. So think of yourself. You want a visa to get a shot at the land of opportunity to express maybe who you could really become. And I truly, for me, America is one of the greatest places, modulo its issues, where you get rewarded for your work. So from that perspective, you come and they're like, yeah, we're going to give you this job. And then they're like, yeah, we don't have funding to give you this job. And you're like, crap. Because now your clock starts and like, what are you going to do? So eventually, the lesson to take away from there is to know a piece of domain knowledge that no one else knew. So in that railroad industry, I became a railroad expert. So the key to my success was alignment of domain expertise. So my personal skill is to interview the sharpest people in a domain and to be able to grok what they do and to be able to speak their language and then make the bridge. So I picked up a piece of technology that was worldwide that five people knew. I became the sixth and the only one that knew all of what they knew. So then they needed me. So I stayed on there. And then through another series of hustling and I think it's good to highlight in your life when alignment happens. So for instance, this meeting, I'm on your podcast and I just met you last night. You see what I'm saying? And so there's certain alignment things that can't sort of be predicted. So I worked in the railroad industry and then I got can I tell a story? I think this is a...
Sure, yeah.
And the importance of the story will become clear. So networking has also been a key to my success. Volunteering and networking. So I meet someone, my friend was putting on a conference in the Caribbean called Tech Beach. So I introduce him to someone. I meet someone in a conference. I introduce him. Sorry. I meet someone who's from my country, randomly in San Francisco. My friend and I decided, oh, we should go to San Francisco and we're going to get funding for the startup. So we were idiots. We would go in a coffee shop, sit, and I'm like watching this guy's computer and I'm seeing, look at investors. I'm like, yeah, we could get money for him. So we talked to a Russian guy and he's like, what are you doing? He's like, you're idiots, go home. So I go to a networking event. I meet a Trini person. I introduce him to my friend. Okay, so this is maybe 2017. A couple of years later, my friend says, hey, you want to come with me to San Francisco to, you know, help me find speakers? I was like, yeah. And I had met another person from Twitter. I introduced him to him. He went to visit a guy on Twitter. met Jack Dorsey, and got Jack Dorsey to come to his conference in Jamaica. So think about it. You get the CEO of Twitter to come to Jamaica to your little conference. So that, my friend's conference blows up. So also, this, the moral of that story is that connections. Making connections will open doors years later. So years later, he calls me, come to San Francisco. He takes me to this fancy dinner with the CEO. The CEO says, what do you do? I'm a data scientist. I work with customers. He's like, yeah, I need one of those. And the guy that I initially met when I went to San Francisco, he was good friends with him. And that company gave me my first six-figure offer coming out to the railroad. Gave me full remote. So I get to live in Florida, six figures. You're like, bro, I live 12 minutes from the beach, six figures, Florida. Like, I'm good. And then after that, funny enough, my friend used me as a reference in my PhD lab. He was being interviewed at NVIDIA. So as a reference for him, so the guy from NVIDIA is now interviewing me. And I was like, what job is this dude going for? He's like, oh, customer-facing data scientist. I was like, I could do that. You got any roles? And that's, and also through another series of networking, I met an NVIDIA who also had kind of put in a referral for me as well. So that was my story to NVIDIA. And to sort of round that off, 2021, so 2006 to 2021, I got my green card then. January 11th, I do my interview on a Monday. I walk into a Mustang dealership. I buy a Mustang on the Wednesday because I got approved on the Monday. I buy a Mustang on the Wednesday. I quit my job and I join NVIDIA on the Thursday. So it was like this insane week of freedom over that journey. So yeah, that's kind of the story. Slightly long-winded, but I think for international students, my personal mandate is to open as many doors as I can. And school is not enough. Real talk, school won't guarantee you get a job as an international student.
From everything I've heard, I completely agree. I also cannot stress the importance of, I wouldn't necessarily call it networking, but I'd call it like...
value adding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's like, if you take genuine curiosity in a lot of people, I find that comes back to you. Right. Because it's not about you meeting them. It's about if you're going out and you're willing to learn about people's stories and genuinely get to know them and you make friends with them, whatever it might be. One, by doing that, you actually learn about what opportunities they might have for you.
Yes.
Right. And not in like an antagonizing way, but in a like, oh, like the deeper you go, the more opportunity you find that to relate or to find an opportunity for yourself. You also find a way that you could potentially help these other people in dramatically different ways. So like just going out and meeting people at volume, I think is ineffective. Mm-hmm. Like we had an awesome, two-hour-long conversation last night. I probably had six or seven of those this week. Those are what is meaningful rather than me just collecting 60 business cards.
Right.
You know, and I think that's something you directly epitomize is that, oh, if you're able to make these long-term meaningful connections, they'll remember you after spending an hour talking to you rather than I can't tell you how many 30, 40 people I met and they gave me a business card or whatever that I will probably never remember again.
Yeah.
And so there's a distinct way to differentiate in that as well.
I wanted to point out, I guess, two pieces of my story that I personally like to highlight that people could use is that there is no, I think what separates me from many people is that there's nothing, no job beneath me. So you could tell me, I literally could have scrubbed toilets. And the way that I got here is that I saw a conference that was $3,000. I emailed the organizer. This is why I went to San Francisco in the first place to start meeting all these people. I said, if I have to scrub toilets, I will do it. And they're like, okay, you figure out how to get here. So that was one. And then two, one of the conferences I volunteered for, now I'm a director of that conference. So now it's given me a platform to open doors for people. So I just wanted to share that in terms of it may take years for you to reap the rewards of adding value to people, but if you really show up and add value and trust that something will come back, I think it usually does.
Yeah. Well, I think that also suggests that there isn't a linear, like one way to do things, right? If you're willing to do things that other people aren't, you have access and opportunities that other people don't. And that's something that that's probably one of my larger tenets in my life is that, you know, if you go, you wake up, you like take a cold shower or something, right?
Yeah.
Most people aren't willing to do that. like maybe what 20% of people would be willing to do something like that, right? Yeah. But that's 80% of people that are doing something. You're doing something that 80% of these people are not. Mm-hmm. And then it gets refined to like your work. Okay, if I'm willing to spend more time or think about this differently or do more research or whatever it is, the amount of people that are willing to follow and do those things as well are dramatically smaller. And the more things you do that these other people don't, the more mm-hmm. you put yourself into this category of one. And the other more opportunities you open yourself to, the more different approaches you take, whether it's, hey, I want to volunteer at this conference. I want to do XYZ. You know, like 3,000 is out of my budget right now, but like you did exactly what was effective for getting you into that thing.
Yep.
And there's no roadmap for that. Mm-hmm. If you were going to create a roadmap or you were going to give advice to, let's say yourself, let's say like 15, 20 years ago.
Yep.
Maybe 15 years ago. I know you're not that old, but what would you recommend for someone in that same scenario? Like, what if you're coming out of Trinidad? What if you're coming out of India and you have the opportunity to either be educated in the US or you're in college right now? What would be the most helpful thing for those people?
So I think, especially in a PhD is a very difficult process. PhD can be an extremely depressing process, to be honest, because oftentimes what you'll observe is that your topic in the grand scheme of things means nothing. But I've also, every time I meet someone who has a PhD, I ask them, why did you do it? I did it because I had to. And for me, along the way that I found solace was to ask a lot of people for advice. That's just my vibe. Now I'm an interviewer. Maybe that was a trend that was happening the whole time. But in addition to that was to continually maintain a certain mental state. So if I show you my wall during my PhD, I literally had a wall over my bed and I would write all these notes to myself. I would just collect quotes. I collect thousands of quotes. So I had an entire wall. It looks horrible from a decoration perspective, especially when you're trying to attract, you know, someone that you want to bring into your social life. And they're like, what the hell is wrong with your room? It's just these weird quotes about being motivated. But I started experimenting. Something that I did was I found a book called The Traveler's Gift. I had a really bad breakup, got super depressed. And I read this book. My grandfather told me the story. He was like a $1 million round table insurance salesman. Okay. Pretty crazy guy. Like he went to Nigeria in the '60s as an Asian guy. He's like pure Asian. So you go to Nigeria in the '60s to sell encyclopedias in the '60s. Like he's hardcore salesman. Anyway, so he was preparing for his exam and he told me he read the entire book, recorded it, and then just listened to recording for like months leading up to the exam. And he would be watching TV and he's listening to it at all times. So the moral of that story is that I recorded this book called The Traveler's Gift. I just found it. And they had some couple of paragraphs in it that really set a good mental framing for how you should, you know, character, adversity, all that stuff. I read that to myself. It was like 20 minutes. And I listened to that, I kid you not, at least 3 or 4 times a day for like the next 10 years. So it was just this, most people I realized can't inject into their mind a certain way of thinking. And that's how I've been experimenting with that is custom motivational talks. That's where I'm at right now. So every time I have an event, like a sporting event, you were talking about is golf, I believe you were into. Imagine I gave you a specific motivational talk from yourself, how you should frame your mind mentally, and then you just drill it into your head. So it's just like an exercise. You're doing that. So I do recommend to folks to find a way to maintain a certain mental outlook for what it is that you're trying to do. And that can help you sort of weather certain storms.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that I haven't done it in a while, but I used to do something fairly similar.
Okay.
I mean, so I am very, obviously very interested in personal development. I've experimented with like hypnosis, with a bunch of these different things. And that is in some sense a form of hypnosis, okay. Right? I would read the tenets that I have every day. I read it and then I would listen to it every day. It's still every day I write in my journal, like the values I have, the goals that I have, and then what I have to do that day, like every day to remind myself to ingrain these things. I went through a phase where I love David Goggins.
He's a beast. Yeah.
And I would listen to one of his interviews every morning. I found this playlist of like every podcast he's ever been on. Mm-hmm. And every morning I would listen to one. And just to sort of get into a mindset of, hey, you can draw from these other people, but you also, when you talk to yourself, I mean, we're used to hearing our own voices. We're used to hearing our voice in our head. It's a very like comforting message.
Yeah.
I get a lot out of the physical interpretation of that. I really like writing things. Mm-hmm. The journaling habit, any of these types of things have been probably some of the most productive for me overall. But I couldn't agree more. I think that the great athletes, the great data scientists, the great whoever it is, there's programming that we do to ourselves, mm-hmm. right? Encoding and constantly remembering these things. But there's also variants to that where you're going out and learning a bunch of things. I like to read things that overlap very intentionally, right? Okay. Where I'll read two books on the same topic because then the important concepts get reinforced. Rather than me having to beat this into me, if I read four books on a similar topic, the message is literally going to, the important messages are always going to be with me because if it's important, all four of those books should have overlapped in that thing.
Yes.
And so I think that there's so many different ways. I love the notes to yourself. You know, Tiger Woods, for example, he would, his dad gave him these affirmation tapes that he actually like wore the tape recordings out.
Wow.
He worked with a hypnotist and sports psychologist early on, and he would give him personalized recordings that he would listen to every day on the way to the golf course, essentially helping him to get into a trance state, but also helping him with his personal understanding, his messaging, and these types of things. And I'm majorly of the belief that we listen to what we say about ourselves. Like I am very, very careful. You'll never hear me tell you that.
Downgrade yourself.
Yeah. You'll never hear me say like, oh, I'm dumb or any of those types of things, because if you say those things enough, you begin to believe them.
Yes.
And on the other side of that, if you say good things enough, that you start to believe those too. And so, you know, I moderated a panel last night.
Yes.
Right. I don't really get nervous when I do those, but you have doubts. Oh, am I going to say the right things? All these types of things. And I'm very particular with my body language. I'm very particular with the things that I go through and tell myself. Particularly the body language, like I grin like a lunatic in the mirror because the your mental state is dictated by your physiology.
Yes.
And so having an understanding of these mechanisms, but even at a deeper level, having an understanding of your own like driving and motivating forces are really important. I mean, we were talking earlier about how, you know, like sometimes you don't necessarily have a choice. You had to do your PhD, you had to do these things. I think that if you have an understanding of yourself and you realize, okay, I'm going to have to do these difficult things to get to where I want to go. Because without a doubt, there is not going to necessarily be a rosy path for anyone.
Right.
But, you know, if you're saying that, okay, I have to get through this to get to these other things in the future, you wouldn't be able to do that and have the proper motivation and have the drive to do that if you didn't understand what your like base state was.
Yes.
Or who you were or the motivating factors you had. Mm-hmm. And I think that's largely what we were talking about earlier, where, you know, understanding your motivations, your passions, whatever it might be, those are all intertwined with where you want to go. And yes, you might have to overcome adversity to get there, but the only way you get through that is like pulling the correct levers from who you are and then learning some of these tools to be able to get to that next stage.
I want to ask you a question. So one of the things that I think helped me during my schooling was just playing sports and staying active. It was a really good mechanism to diffuse stress and kind of mitigate depression. Cause technically I would have considered myself depressed, not in the clinical sense. You know, you do therapy and all that stuff. What is your self-talk when you come upon this doubting situation? Cause I don't hear many people talk about that in a lot of these data science podcasts, from the perspective of, hey, look at Chris Stewart last night. I wonder, and I asked him, what do you tell yourself? Like, how much do you doubt yourself as you go through this process? What's your mental framing for pushing into the unknown?
So at the very most basic level, it boils down to a growth versus a fixed mindset. So even if I can't do something now, I believe over time if I put in the effort, I'll be able to get there. And that's almost exactly what Chris Diat was telling us about having doubts. Is he says, if I have enough time and enough resources, I should be able to solve almost any problem that I might have. Do I want to actually invest all that time in those resources? Maybe not, start. Right? But to me, that is at the core of those doubts. I also have read quite a few books about the cycles that our mind go into. A great book on that is called Chatter by Ethan Cross.
Ooh, okay.
And there's a ton of strategies that you can use. So the first is looking at your own successes over time. Something I do every single day is I write down three of the wins that I had each day. So there's another book called The Winner Effect. And so basically, if we start winning, our physiology adapts to that and produce more testosterone. There's a lot of actual benefits, but we can frame things as wins rather than just having to purely win in like a combat scenario or something along those lines, right?
Yes.
So looking at past successes and creating a backlog and a history and a track of that, you can start looking back and say, oh, I've done similar things in the past. I have a map for doing things in the future. So even if I'm facing adversity, I can look and I can probably find at this point something that's a corollary that I've overcome or that I've done to be able to map to whatever this future problem that I have is. Another way is using temporal distancing. So if you think about 5 years in the future, is this going to be even an issue? No. If you look back when you were a child and you're thinking, okay, would I even care about this as a seven-year-old?
Yeah.
Right. So there's different ways that you can use your imagination or you can use a third party perspective. Another one is, a good one I really like is evaluating the scenario as if you were a third party. So if I'm facing a problem and I took your perspective and said, okay, Mark's giving me advice on this, what would he say? That's another way to get out of the intensity that you have. So whenever you're facing these negative thought spirals, you're usually too close to the problem. So the best way is to get psychological distance. And those are some different ways to do that. A very easy way to get psychological distance, probably the easiest way, is to speak to yourself in the second or third person.
Oh, I haven't tried that one.
So you just say from athletes all the time. You're like, you can do this or you're better than this or whatever it might be. And there's a good research. There's an experiment called, it's called the Batman effect. And basically they gave kids a really difficult problem and they either the control group is you just try to solve it or the activity group is that they take on the role of Batman or Dora the Explorer. And what they found is that the kids who took on the Batman role, the Dora the Explorer role, they were saying things to themselves like Batman wouldn't give up here or Batman has a utility belt and he can solve this and things like that. And so to me, that's a very powerful phenomenon, right? Is that if we take on these other roles, whatever it might be, and that's just psychological distance, right?
So it's almost like we're prompting them.
Yeah, effectively. Yeah. And there's a very cool corollary between large language models in this sense and humans is that we have unbelievable power if we distance, we take on different roles, do whatever that might be. Actually, in my other podcast, I literally just released the episode on Chatter. I read the whole book and gave a little overview. That's why this is so fresh in my mind. If people want to check that out, obviously completely different domain, not data science, but very, very interesting to me, obviously.
I want to ask, so technically it's not a data science, but I think it has corollary into data science because I think anyone who aspires to be great at what they do, there are these strategies for work and then there are these strategies for just pain tolerance and discomfort tolerance. So in working out, I've been trying these mnemonic reps. So instead of counting, I actually just say a phrase. So if I say, I know what I can do this, right? That's 10. That's 10 reps. So instead of counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, I say this phrase. So it kind of pushes me in a different frame, especially when you're really exerting yourself. And I was wondering if you had experienced something similar, even both in work and then in your stress management strategies for, because you're an athlete and, you know, you got injured and I see like you like to push yourself and I, you know, you're pushing yourself to produce all this content and it correlates across domains.
That's a good question. I actually really like that. The thing, I like to do difficult things, and then that makes it easier to do other difficult things, right? You sort of get there's good science around this. Like, there's a part of your brain that if you do difficult things, it like builds more tolerance to that, and it's easier to do more difficult things. Mm-hmm. But I also like to be able to find joy in the process.
Yeah.
And what I've seen in a lot of people is they find ways to gamify what they're doing. They find ways to play, and they find ways to experiment in what they're doing. And to me, that's another really beautiful source of motivation.
Yeah.
From all of the most exceptional people that I've talked to, whether it's athletes, whether it's incredible data scientists, competitors, whatever it might be, there's not just a singular thing that motivates them, right? There's usually multiple forces that are also, some of them, kind of dark, right? Yes. Where,
yeah, that's true.
I know for me, historically, it doesn't really come up that often anymore, but there was like some inadequacy in terms of like dating and things like that, that was a huge motivating factor for me. So maybe if I can be successful, I'll find a partner that I really care about. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, I have a great partner now. I love her to death. And like, frankly, that's not a good motivating force for me
anymore. Right. So that faded away.
But exactly. So like, if that was my only motivating force, where would I be? Probably wouldn't be where I'm at now. Not that I'm at some incredible place, but like, that's the point, is that there's these multiple levels. I mean, another one is like self-actualization and understanding myself. That's something that probably won't ever go away, but that's also not necessarily something that is an unbelievable, like, quick jolting force.
Yes.
And so I think that whenever I get stuck, whenever I get in a place where I feel apathetic or whatever it is, it's thinking about the multiple different driving forces and even finding new ones, right? I mean, like, I look in the mirror now, I haven't been training a lot, because I've been injured and stuff.
Yeah.
But I look at my body, I'm like, dude, this is gross. Like, I don't like how my body looks. Saliva. Yeah. And it's like, that's okay. I mean, it doesn't mean it's going to be like that forever. If I looked in 10 months and didn't like how I looked then, still, there would be something inherently problematic about that. Mm-hmm. Right. But I know for myself, like, I can talk bad to myself in that sense.
Right.
Because it's a motivating force. Mm-hmm. And I've created enough self-confidence, enough of these other forces to build myself up, where I now can use that as leverage. And I mean, to me, that's one massive power of improving your self-esteem, understanding your self-worth, is that you can now pull these darker levers and not affect the maybe depressive side or some of these bad parts about your psychology. Not saying everyone should necessarily go down that route all the time, but
it's painful.
But there's multiple things that you can do to really push yourself to the next level, which is, I guess, the overarching idea.
Yeah, I want to share a perspective on. So I'm very big on career optimization. That's what I study with the other AI portfolio podcast. It's just all about, I'm interviewing people about, I watch jumps. So what I like to do, I like to go on LinkedIn and you watch how people have arced their career. And I think one of the things when you go to arc your career is this notion of, you know, whatever standards you're sort of holding yourself to. But it's also, I think, in the space of data science, there's hardcore research scientists. There are sort of folks maybe in the data analytics space. Well, actually, there's just two. You're either a hardcore research scientist, or there's a space where you interact with customers. So the criteria to be successful in that environment is very different. And there are many factors that I think a lot of people don't take into consideration. They're like, oh, I did my degree and I'm not getting a job. But what if you showed up to an interview? Your breath smelled really bad and you went to talk to someone and you talked to that person for a whole hour and your breath smelled the whole room. It's interesting. So I've experienced it in these things. So during my PhD, I made a considered effort, you know, PhD is loose, you do whatever. One day I was like, no, I need to prep for where I'm going. So I started dressing like as if I was rolling up in work, and my advisor looks at me like, what the hell are you doing? He comes in shorts and stuff like that. I was like, no, I'm prepping for where I'm going. And being a client-facing data scientist, there are many things that I personally think you have to show up to the table. So for me, being, you know, well-dressed, checking my wood. If you look at my bag, I have deodorant, toothbrush, all kind of stuff. Just so that I remove all of those factors to maximize my chance. And then for me, this is just a personal standard, not embarking this on anyone, is that I've aligned my identity to someone who has a six pack. That's how I continue to work out.
Yeah.
So if I see that fade out, that is not me. And that's a forcing mechanism because I actually don't like working out. I'm getting to enjoy it a little more now as a stress relieving mechanism, but shit's painful. You know what I mean? So I just kind of wanted to highlight that in terms of, we talk about data science, talk about getting certifications, taking courses, how you show up and the confidence that you instill into someone about your ability to solve their problem, I think is critically important. And then the second thing, a good thought experiment is, do whatever it takes to produce 10x the revenue for that company. So take your salary, if it's 100K, multiply that by two, that's your cost to the company. So now you literally have to bring in $2 million from your work to actually be valuable to that company. And if you go by that measure, I think it just aligns you to, it takes care of a lot of things that you might maybe focus on a little too microscopically.
Yeah. Well, I want to highlight what you were saying about identity. So you're talking about, you identify as someone who has a six pack, right?
Yeah.
That for a lot of people is something that is really difficult to change.
Mm-hmm,
it is. Where let's say you're like a larger person and you're like, oh, I'm a fat person, but I'm on a diet, mm-hmm. right? You'll never lose the weight because you're in your mind.
You're still right. The wording.
That fat person, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we see that in the professional setting as well, is you could just be a data scientist. Like, oh, I'm a data scientist, I just haven't landed a job yet. Mm. And I don't think that that's the prevailing psychology around it. Mm. But there's a great book called The Alter Ego Effect, which I really recommend. I actually interviewed Todd Herman, the author, on my other podcast.
Very cool. Very cool.
But the idea of changing your identity is actually very simple, or stepping into another identity. But we don't realize we have the power to do that. And to create incredibly fast behavioral change. You obviously have to still do the right habits and do all these other things. Right. But those habits come a lot more naturally if you've already made that identity shift in your brain. Mm-hmm. And so to me, there's like one of the most impressive hacks for creating those standards is just stepping into who you would like to be, mm-hmm. or like believing that you are already that person. Like if you already are that person, you just do things that are in line with who that person is. It's not that complicated.
Yeah.
Right. But we overcomplicate these things. Oh, I have to do all this behavior change. I have to make these habits. I have to do these things. And it's no, you just have to change what the paradigm is. You change what your essentially like your base principles are, or your core, or the foundations of what you believe. Yeah. And to me, that's an incredible, incredibly powerful force.
Yes. That's why I'm super interested in pain tolerance, because I've noticed that all the experts I've worked with, and I'm very fortunate at NVIDIA, there's just brilliant people. And like you could come up with a PhD and there's just folks that are just light years ahead of you. And to be humbled from that perspective and just to absorb and to be like, wow, could I be as good as that person? It does create this kind of distance, but it also, it's like, wow, that's reality. It's there in front of you. It's possible. It's just an ugly, sometimes very painful amount of work. So I think Jensen's recent video really calmed a lot of my stress that I might have been having at work, because you know GTC is a really stressful time. Like everybody in the company is just swarming towards that. So I just point that out in terms of just think of pain tolerance as a career hack.
Well, let's end it here. I'd love to follow up, do a little talk about the entrepreneurship side, the podcasting side as well. I think we'll have an awesome conversation about that. But
this is fantastic. Thank you, my friend. Thanks for letting me come on the show.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Ken's Nearest Neighbors. Many of you have been asking about how you can support the show, and we're extremely grateful for all the engagement so far. The best way that you can show your support is to subscribe to both the Ken's Nearest Neighbors and the Ken's Nearest Neighbors Clips YouTube channels. If you're listening to us on Spotify or Apple Music, giving us a rating and sharing any of the episodes with someone that you believe might find the content useful is also greatly appreciated. The Ken's Nearest Neighbors podcast is hosted by me, Ken G, produced by Bobby Hicks, and is edited by Mario Paul and Tony Pelleriti.